Hi, I'm Femi Okay. Today on the stream, what happens when climate activists take direct action? Let's take a look at a few examples from this year. We're going to start in February. Activists in Canada caused millions of dollars in damage this year and halted operations on a key work site for a multi-billion dollar natural gas pipeline project. In March, Tire Extinguishers launches in the United Kingdom. This leaderless group aims to make owning SUVs in cities impossible, and they have deflated thousands of vehicle tyres around the world. One more example for you. August, climate activists in the south of France fill golf course holes with cement to protest a water ban exemption for golf greens amid a severe drought, saying that economic madness is taking precedence over ecological reason. So in this episode of The Stream, could embracing climate sabotage help save our planet? I know you've got thoughts. Our YouTube comment section is live. Looking forward to seeing you in it.
As climate activists, we have carried out campaigns, we have carried out strikes, we have carried out protests and march to call the attention of the government to address the climate crisis. The government have made promises without taking any action. And as climate activists, we need to take a step further to push, because the government is not giving ears to all our campaigns.
The problem is that taking that course of action would likely have the exact opposite effect. It would be a gift to the right-wing opponents of climate action, who would use it, leverage it for all it's worth to accelerate their creeping fascism, make the issue politically toxic for moderate voters, arrest a generation of young climate activists, and sow division in the climate movement itself.
Joining us to talk about their various degrees of activism when it comes to climate crisis, we have Andreas and Nisreen and Charlotte. Good to have all three of you here in the stream. Andreas, will you please introduce yourself to our global audience? Tell them who you are in the connection of today's episode. What do they need to know about you very briefly?
Well, I'm Andreas Malm. I teach human ecology at Lund University here in Sweden. And I guess I'm on this show because I wrote a book called How to Blow Up a Pipeline, Learning to Fight in a World on Fire, which advocates for sabotage and property destruction as methods that the climate movement should experiment with now that the situation is so dire. And I think what we're seeing right now are the first signs of the climate movement in the global north doing this. And I think more is coming.
Nisreen, welcome to the stream. Welcome back, I should say. It's always good to have you on board. Will you introduce yourself to the audience, remind them who you are, what you do?
Thank you. My name is Nisreen Al-Saim. I'm from Sudan. I'm the chair of the UN Secretary General's Youth Advisory Group on Climate Change, and I'm a climate activist for 10 years now.
Good to have you. And welcome, Charlotte. Please say hello to the stream viewers around the world. Tell them what you do.
Hi, I'm Charlotte Grubb. I'm a climate justice activist, and I'm an organizer on the Free Jess Res team.
I'm wondering, Charlotte, at what point do you abandon diplomacy, climate negotiation, talking to your nemesis, perhaps, talking to policymakers who are not thinking about the future, and then say, I need to take direct action? When does that happen?
I mean, I don't think of it as a binary. I don't think you need to abandon, you know, as the word that you chose, those other tactics and do something like property destruction. I think that we need a diversity of tactics. I think we need policy change. I think we need legal challenges. I think we need direct action. You know, I think that would be the most successful way, is using a variety of tactics.
Yet, using tactics needs to do a cost-benefit analysis. You always need to see or calculate how much benefit I'm going to get from using this tactic and how much cost it costs me. And if the tactics cost more than the benefit it brings, then it doesn't call tactic. It just means that it's a failed trial.
Andreas.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with both of these points. And I think the purpose of sabotage would be to amass greater striking force for the climate movement. And so far, we haven't really managed to inflict serious material costs on fossil capital. And that is what urgently needs to happen, because the situation right now is that the more the world burns, the more fossil fuels are poured on the fire. And it just cannot go on like this. And our governments have so far completely failed in reining in this virtually demonic force that is bent on burning down the planet as fast as possible. And if governments fail so conspicuously, then someone else has to step in. And that's what people around the world are beginning to do, take action of their own. But I agree, that's not a question of abandoning other tactics. It's a question of trying to put greater pressure on governments to do what is necessary, because of their own volition, of their own accord, they're clearly incapable of doing that. They have to be pushed.
If you have a government, if you have a government in the first place.
Sure.
I mean, coming from Sudan, it's just funny for me to talk about governments these days.
So, Andreas, you said something which jumped at me, which was inflict. It's like you inflict damage on the fossil fuel industries. So is this, in your mind, a battle? I'm just looking at your book that came out in 2021, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. So it's almost like you're going to the front lines. You're not waiting any longer for diplomacy, for negotiations.
No, because the UN climate negotiations that have been going on for three decades have presided over a constant increase in CO2 emissions. I mean, CO2 emissions globally have just continued to balloon while these negotiations have been happening year after year. So clearly that's a massive, epic failure. And we cannot wait for that to just continue forever. It's just dragging out and not doing anything to limit, let alone abolish, business as usual. So clearly we have to do something else. I mean, I don't see how you can avoid the conclusion that we have to try something more than what we've done so far. It hasn't been enough to wait for negotiators, to petition, to lobby, to march, to demonstrate, to gently ask for politicians to listen to the science. We need to also do something more. And that's the phase that the climate movement in the global north is in. And I'm not from Sudan. I'm from one of the countries that is perpetrating climate injustice on people in countries like Sudan or other parts of the global south. I'm active in Europe, which is the original cradle of the fossil economy, where this whole climate crime began. And here we do have governments. And what they do in, for instance, Norway, the neighboring country here, is that they're just abetting and encouraging ever-expanding extraction of fossil fuels. And there is reason to be mad about that.
The funny thing, Andreas, the funny thing is most of the developed countries or the European countries' projects of oil and gas are actually not happening in these countries where you have a legal system that might actually protect the activists who do this sabotaging or blowing up the pipelines. It's happening in countries where activists can just be killed for striking in front of a forest, for example. So that's why when you talk about different tools, when you talk about doing more, I really think of different ways of more, different mores, as you may say. And yes, diplomacy is being failing us as a generation and failing the planet in actually reaching the point that we want to reach. But if you use the tool wrong, it doesn't mean that the tool have a problem. And if you plant a tree and don't irrigate it, it doesn't mean that the tree itself or the soil itself is not proper. It means that you're not taking care of it. And it, just to remind all of you, the negotiations or the diplomacy or wherever is the systems that people created, and people should change it as long as it's not working instead of just trying something else. And I think as someone who's been through this negotiation,
excuse me for jumping in here. I want to bring Charlotte into the conversation. Charlotte, because when we're talking about direct action, you know what that is like and you have done it and there have been repercussions. So this is the other side of that. It's not just we are going to go out and we're going to slash tyres, deflate tyres, fill golf courses with cement to stop the privilege from using water when the rest of us can't. You've actually done that direct action. And then what happened to you?
Yeah, thanks. I have done different direct actions as part of the Dakota Access Pipeline protests. I had locked myself to a horizontal drill that was boring under the Des Moines River, which is a source of drinking water for 40 million people. And I was charged with a felony. I served a month in jail. I had to pay, I think it was $7,000 in restitution and $65 per day in jail when I was in there. And, you know, I'm here to speak on behalf of my friend Jess, who's locked up for 8 years. And I really appreciate, Nisreen, your comment about the very real risks people face with this. Like, it's exciting to purport those, you know, tactics. And I think acting outside of what has been working is important. But I think I'm here today to speak about the increased criminalization of water protectors, the increased criminalization of protesters, and how we're seeing, especially in the U.S., you know, emerging of the oil and gas industry and corporate interests, as well as the government. That's really pretty terrifying, to be honest.
This is, I'm just going to show our audience a little clip of Jessica Reznacek, and you can tell her more about her story. But I want our audience to understand that she was doing direct action on a pipeline, and she ended up, as she currently is right now, serving 8 years in prison for domestic terrorism in the United States. Let's have a look at part of her story.
In her statement, Jessica wrote that after exhausting all avenues of process, from petitions for environmental impact statements and public comment periods, to hunger strikes, marches, boycotts, and civil disobedience, she took her actions as a last resort.
Biden's Department of Justice has declared Jessica a domestic terrorist, sentenced her to 8 years in prison and millions of dollars in fines paid to the pipeline company.
Her case is important, and it's because it's not unique.
Laws specifically criminalizing environmental protests have now been passed or put on the table in most U.S. states.
The moment anyone seriously challenges a corporation's freedom to push us closer to the cliff,
the government uses the language of terrorism and they make you disappear.
So Jessica and her friend Charlotte, they sabotaged the Dakota Access Pipeline, firebombs, they used a soldering unit, and for that she's serving 8 years in prison as a domestic terrorist. Is that not a sobering thought in terms of how do we get people's attention? How do we save our planet? If on the other side of that, there's jail time.
Yeah. So just to clarify, I was not the other person. Jessica acted with another woman, and that was not me. The actions I spoke about were separate. But it is real, and Jessica was labeled a domestic terrorist, and that increased her sentence fivefold. And she's just finished a year in prison, and she has an eight-year sentence. She has to pay $3.2 million in restitution to Energy Transfer Partners, the company that owns the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Charlotte, you just said that like it's no big deal. Over $3 million. How does a normal, everyday individual come up with $3 million?
That's a great question. I mean, I definitely don't have an answer to that. And I think it really speaks to, you know, how high the, you know, the fossil fuel industry is increasing the risks to try to intimidate activists from acting. And, you know, in Jess's case, this isn't random. We know exactly why this happened. This is politically motivated. In 2017, 84 Congress members, four Democrats, 80 Republicans, wrote a letter to then Attorney General Jeff Sessions asking specifically in the wake of Standing Rock protests that people who tamper or impede with fossil fuel infrastructure be prosecuted as domestic terrorists. They specifically mentioned punctures and valves, because this was also trying to target the valve turners. And then Jessica's prosecution or label as a domestic terrorist is an exact answer to this letter. So we know exactly why this happened. And those 84 Congress members who wrote this letter, they received $36 million from the fossil fuel industry. So we know that the fossil fuel industry is just trying to protect their assets and the government's doing their bidding to do that.
Andres, go ahead.
I think that, the important thing to point out here is that it's fundamentally bizarre that Jessica Reznacek, who never harmed an individual, never injured anyone, never killed anyone, is labeled a terrorist. when in fact the extraction and combustion of fossil fuels are killing people on a daily basis, indiscriminately killing civilians, particularly in the global south. This we know for a fact. If there is anything here that can be classified as terrorism, it should be large-scale fossil fuel extraction and combustion. Obviously, the laws are totally skewed and twisted, so the presumed terrorist here is the one who tries to destroy the machinery that destroys lives and ecosystems around the planet.
So that's your moral stance on why this direct action is necessary. But if you have a young woman who is now serving time as a domestic terrorist, is that not a chilling effect and makes you think twice about how do we go about getting people's attention in a productive way without landing ourselves in prison?
Yes. And the first thing we should think about is how do we accomplish the most without ending up in jail? How do we avoid repression?
How do you?
Yeah, well, you should ask the 20 people who destroyed that coastal gas link construction site in British Columbia that you started off with, because as far as I know, they've all evaded arrest, which I think is a great thing. That you can go in and destroy a site where a pipeline is being constructed and just get away with it. Likewise, I don't know of anyone in the tire extinguishers who's been arrested. And I think this is a step away from the civil disobedience protocol of Extinction Rebellion and other groups who have made it a virtue of to get arrested.
Yeah.
Part of our action is to almost throw ourselves into the arms of the police and end up in jail. I think we've had enough.
Was that what you were doing? Because you got scooped up and you did some jail time. Did you care that you were caught?
I mean, yes. Nobody wants to be arrested.
You were chained to a big piece of equipment, so you were definitely going to get caught, right? That was not a ninja move.
Yeah. I mean, I think this speaks to the bigger issue of an escalation of tactics. You know, in that case, we and Jessica had, you know, Jessica ran with the Lakota youth during the permitting process of the Army Corps of Engineers. And, you know, I've been a part of so many projects where, like, we submit comments as part of the EIS statement. We, you know, hold signs.
EIS statement?
Environmental impact statement. So that's part of the permitting process. You know, and so you can do civil disobedience outside of a place. Just did hunger strikes. And so there is like this escalation where you're doing things. And I think the role of direct action in this case can be to highlight an injustice that's taking place in a way that traditional media, such as like an op-ed or writing, it just can't, you know. And so I think highlighting how high the stakes are is something that direct action, you know, can really bring to a situation.
Let me bring in a new voice into our conversation, a new voice, but an old, very well-known face. Leslie James Pickering is a former spokesperson for the Earth Liberation Front. Back in their day, they did a lot of sabotage. And this is Leslie explaining what the purpose is. What happens when you're successfully completing a sabotage mission? Have a listen.
It creates the scenario where there is now consequence for bad behavior in a society where there is no consequence for bad behavior. A corporation can go and cut down a forest and pollute and what have you, and at the worst, they get a fine that they have no problem paying. And they just go on with business as usual. But after the Earth Liberation Front step on the scene, you know, they have to stop and think about, is what I'm doing going to upset these environmentalists so much that I'm going to be the next target of a large-scale arson attack? Will my company be burnt down? And if they are the target of that kind of thing, well, that's going to cost them several things. It's cost them some money and some time and some anguish, and hopefully cause them to, you know, rethink what it is that they're doing.
Are we seeing a different kind of climate saboteur now, Andreas, from two or three decades ago?
Yeah, I think the Earth Liberation Front that was at its peak in the 1990s did not have a specific focus on climate, because this was environmentalism before climate breakdown had set in. Now we have a more strategic I think, precision in the sense that we're going after primarily fossil fuel infrastructure and luxury emissions along the lines of driving SUVs in rich neighborhoods. And I think this is more appropriate for the current moment because the climate crisis really is, I mean, obviously it's just one part of a much broader ecological crisis, but it is the most urgent problem that we're facing. And I expect that we'll, and I hope that we can continue to have that kind of precision rather than a kind of, you know, general assault on industrial civilization or something like that.
Yeah. Charlotte, I'm going to bring in a new voice here. I would love you to respond. This is Tamana, and she is in India. She spoke to us just a few hours ago about a different approach to changing people's ability to act immediately during the climate crisis. Here she is.
The majority of our population is just struggling to get by. They're not even aware of the crises that are affecting them. So for a lot of grassroots organizations, it's more about taking the awareness to these communities and working on mindset shifts and adaptation for them instead of really targeting the authorities and the corporates, which is a much larger process and is more dangerous.
Charlotte, thoughts?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I appreciate what Tamana said, but in terms of, I like what Leslie brought in terms of accountability for these corporations. And like with the case of the Dakota Access Pipeline, a federal judge came to rule that it's operating illegally. So the permits that Dakota Access Pipeline had to go through are illegal, and it's operating now. It leaked multiple times within its first 6 months of operation. It's leaked over 2 million gallons of this drilling mud into pristine wetlands. And that, I think, is the catch-22 of living in an extractive and colonial system where the only way to stop an illegally built pipeline in a legal way is to let it be built and then after the fact realize that it wasn't legal to begin with. But at that point, it's already built. And so I think, you know, finding ways for accountability for these corporations is important, and also not just the corporations, but also the courts. And with Jess, that's what we realized in the appeal process with her, was we were challenging the domestic terrorism label. And as part of the appeal process, and the appeal was denied, the judges basically in their decision said that labeling Jess a domestic terrorist was a harmless error. And
so what's our lesson that we learn as an international audience listening to Jess's story? Isn't it just that the repercussions are so huge?
The repercussions are huge. But it's also, I think for us, this is much bigger than just, you know, and that's why we're worried. This is about a merging of the fossil fuel industry and the government. This is about a threat to our
democracy. Bigger than Jess. Andres.
Definitely.
Andres, go ahead.
Yeah, but this is the kind of problem that every movement in history that has challenged vested interests has had to face. Namely, a state apparatus that is totally beholden to these vested interests. And with that comes the problem of repression, that you end up in jail. But I don't know of any movement in history that has struggled for emancipation and has totally evaded the problem of imprisonment or considerably worse.
Right.
And clearly, this is the case in countries in the global south to a much greater degree than in the north, because levels of repression are much higher in countries such as India, South Africa, not to mention the countries in Latin America where environmental activists are killed on virtually a daily basis. And I think the comrade from India made an important point here that Nisreen from Sudan made it as well, and that is that every choice of tactics has to be adapted to the local concrete circumstances. And I'm certainly not arguing that everyone, everywhere, should do only sabotage, and that is the magical bullet that will bring us to a world of climate stability.
Andres, thank you. It's been interesting listening to your perspective. Charlotte as well. Nisreen, thank you so much for being part of this conversation. So many interesting thoughts here on YouTube as well. Angeline says, the worst thing I hear is people that don't even believe in climate change and don't care what's happening on the other side of the world. And that is shameful. Thanks for watching. I'll see you next time. Take care.